Shrink Wrap Radio number 402, Techniques for Relieving Depression Without Medication, with Bill O'Hanlon.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Bill O'Hanlon, licensed marriage family therapist and popular workshop leader, and we'll be discussing his latest book, Out of the Blue, 6 Non-Medication Ways to Relieve Depression. For more detail on Bill O'Hanlon, please go to the show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Bill O'Hanlon, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back. As you know, because you heard through the grapevine, I was a fan of your show before I was on the first time. This is our second time, I believe. I continue to be a fan of your show. I'm amazed at the wonderful people you get on and the great content. And I love learning, and I love the price too.
Yeah, right. Well, I heard that from Ron Alexander,
right,
our mutual friend.
But
I was a little skeptical. I thought, nah, you can't be.
I'm a big podcast listener. I love to use my time when I'm walking or running or grocery shopping or driving.
Exactly.
I just think it's so great. I'm learning all the time, and you have such great content, and it's terrific people. You're a good interviewer too, and you just have good taste.
Yeah, well, thank you. And present company is proof of that. Now, I've been loving your new book, Techniques for Relieving Depression Without Medication, and one of the things I really like about it is that it's written in a very down-to-earth conversational style, as if you were speaking to the reader right across from you. In fact, I'm wondering if this started out as a workshop and then developed into a book.
It did. This is my 36th book, and I have discovered that when I teach the workshop, I have for years. I'm winding down at this point as I hit my dotage, but I was traveling 3 or 4 times a month and teaching. And when I teach a workshop 40 or 50 times, I get the best questions. I organize it. I get really good examples. And yes, so it came right out of a workshop I did. And it also came out of a personal experience that I had when I was depressed when I was younger. So this one felt a little more personal than a lot of my psychotherapy books do.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I get the feeling that you were speaking to therapists primarily in this book, but also secondarily to general readers who might be depressed. Do I have that right?
It is funny because I had to rewrite the book. This is the only time I've had to rewrite it because I kept slipping into that if you're depressed. And my editor kept reminding me, this is a book for professionals now. This is a book for therapists. I said, yeah, but some of them are depressed. He goes, yeah, Bill, you're right. But really, don't write it. Write it to them to use it with other people. But I do write in such an accessible way now after I've written so many books. I've learned to do that. Not a lot of jargon, very conversational, that you can easily translate it into your own life. So, yes. Yeah, it's for both, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder if the publisher pushed you towards something that I find very annoying is so many books have all these exercises at the end, of every chapter, there are a bunch of exercises.
I never do the exercises.
Yeah, I hate that stuff, probably because I'm a jaded professional. But you did a nice little almost end run around that by having places where you'd kind of coach the reader. Okay, now here's a kind of way that you could make an intervention. You could say something.
Cover it
with your hand here.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, you have to trust the reader that they're going to not cheat.
Yeah, yeah. I cheated a little bit.
I
found it hard. I wasn't as good as you are.
Well, I know the answer. That's the key. That's the key. But, they pushed me to go back and include those.
Uh-huh.
And I guess it's a good thing because you think, oh, this idea sounds great, But if you're really a counselor, therapist, even a coach, how do I put it into practice? So I'm big on that practical stuff. And I thought, okay, I understand. If somebody needs it, I like you, I really am annoyed when they come to the end of it and they go, okay, here's your quiz or here's your exercise. I never do those, but I just try to incorporate right in there some obvious examples and then stretch your brain a little and see if you can guess, you know, what might be a good response.
So. Yeah. You know, your publisher remarked that, or you remarked, one of you remarked that, well, therapists could be depressed too. Yeah. And that's certainly the case. And actually, I wondered if people who become therapists might actually be more disposed to becoming depressed at some point in their lives. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think they're more likely to have some sort of wound of some kind that's emotional or psychological or relational. And I think, you know, it's sometimes a little bit of an insult that's said about psychologists or therapists saying, oh, you only went into this because you're so screwed up yourself, or you tried to fix yourself or your family. And I say, yeah, I suppose that's somewhat true for some people, but I'd rather say it in a more nuanced way. Maybe we went into this field, those of us who became helpers in the mental health and emotional ranges and relational ranges, because we were sensitized to the pain and suffering and how that happens in people's lives and also how we recover from it. So, you know, I know you've been very open in your show, you know, at times, and I have too when I've taught and when I've written. I think it's a bit of a dismissal to say therapists are just screwed up and that's why they went into this field. They were hurt, like most people in this life, wounded in some way, but they took it and turned it into a contribution to other people, helping other people relieve their suffering, move on from troubles. So that's the way I think about it. Yeah, I think we are a little more likely than the average bear to have suffered something in our childhoods or adolescence or early adulthood.
Well, I wish I could have thought of that nuanced answer when I was in graduate school and a non-clinical professor laid that trip on me.
Yeah, I've heard it a few times, more than once.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned in the beginning, and you're very candid, that this book has its origins in a very severe depression that you experienced when you were college age. Maybe you could take us through that.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing because I know you have a bit of a background in this too, but I was influenced by Milton Erickson, and I remember reading a book about Milton Erickson's work by Jay Haley, Uncommon Therapy.
Yes.
And he had a point there that I didn't know until much later. But when people are going through life transitions, they have to develop new skills, they have to make transitions. They have to sometimes even change their identity, how they see themselves, how other people see them. And they get stuck sometimes on those transition times when they first get married, when they first have a child, when they first leave home, when they retire, you know, when the last kid leaves home, that kind of stuff. And I think I was one of those. I didn't transition well. I was a very shy kid. I grew up in a big Irish Catholic family, 8 kids, and my family encouraged us to go very, very far away to become independent, which was a good thing, but I was the shy one. I was the anxious one, unconfident, and I went to a massively large university, Arizona State, where sometimes there'd be 500 people in a 101 class, and I just got lost. And I think when I was growing up, the meanings were just handed to me. And, you know, you go to university, as most university students, I started questioning everything. It was, this will carbon date me a little, but it was hippie time. And it was, you know, I started experimenting with some of those substances that hippies do. And I started taking philosophy, questioning reality, questioning everything I'd ever been taught. And I lost my sense of meaning. Plus, I was very shy, so I got very isolated, and I became more and more depressed. And finally, I hit a place where I just didn't get up for weeks. I didn't go to class. I didn't see anybody. I would sleep for 20 hours a day. I had no idea what depression was at that time. And life became more and more bleak and more meaningless. And finally, one day, I just was like, why do people get out of bed? Why does anybody do anything? And I started thinking about ways that I could end it all. And I had, luckily for me, I had three friends that I'd made. They were about as alienated as I was for the most part. We didn't spend a lot of time together, but we made a little bond at the beginning of university. And so I decided, you know, if I kill myself, it's going to be a rude shock to them. I was a polite kid, you know, anxious and wanted everybody to like me kind of thing. And I went over to say goodbye to the first two, and they were, yeah, I'm as miserable as you are, but I'm afraid to die. I admire your courage. If I could end it, I would. So they were really supportive of my decision. And they said, I'm sure, you know, we were all into these weird beliefs at this point. They said, I'm sure we'll see each other in our next incarnation. It's got to be better because we suffered so much in this life. And off I went to my third and final friend, who was more normal. And she was really upset. She said, no, you can't kill. No, why would you kill your? I said, oh, you know, I can't get out of bed. I don't know the meaning of anything. I don't get why people do anything. Plus, we're in this kind of protected environment of the university now. And in a few years, I'm going to have to go out and work. I'm not going to be able to work. Number one, I don't believe in, you know, American corporations. At that time, it was the Vietnam War, and I was thinking they were all evil and making napalm to drop on little babies in Vietnam. So I couldn't morally do it, but I couldn't even physically do it. I wasn't able to get out of bed. And so I thought, oh, I'm protected now because I sort of have my tuition paid and a little room and board. But what am I going to do when I have to work? It's going to get worse as years, not better. And so she said, look, don't do this. And I said, I have to. And she said, look, I have some aunts, three aunts. They live in Nebraska. They've never married. They've been frugal. They've saved all their money. I'm their favorite niece. They tell me they're going to leave me everything when they die. And so they've invested in farmland because a lot of the farmers were moving off the land at that point in Nebraska. And they also have savings. And on those farms, they just lease them out to the next door neighbor farmer. And when I inherit one of these farms, I promise you can go and live on one of those farms. You don't have to be around people, which was my concern. You can write your poetry, which was what I was doing at that point. And, you know, you'll be able to be alone, but okay. You won't have to work. You won't have to engage with the rest of the world. You could grow your own food, which in my delusional state, reading Mother Earth News in 1960, I actually believed I could do. I grew up in a suburb of Chicago. I tried it later. Really hard to grow your own food. But that appealed to me, and I thought, well, you know, if I didn't have to deal with people, I didn't have to work, you know, and there wasn't any pressure on me, and I could do whatever I want and just write and do my creative stuff, maybe it'd be worth living. But I didn't say yes right away. I said, how old are your aunts? And she said, they're in their 60s. And I thought, at 19, I thought, well, they're almost dead. So, you know,
right.
Like, now that I'm in that age range, I'm thinking it's relatively young, really. And those aunts live till 90 eventually. But her promise to me helped me decide. She made me promise not to kill myself. And then I had another dilemma. I was here. I was still miserable, but I wasn't suicidal anymore. I'd given that up. But I had to figure out how to be less miserable. And, you know, we were talking a little earlier. That, I think, led directly to me becoming a therapist because I got really interested. How do people find meaning in life? How do they find purpose? How do they get less miserable? How do they get along with themselves and other people? And that led me directly to becoming a psychotherapist.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Such a story. And what an offer for that friend to say, hey, you know, I will essentially give you a farm.
Yeah. Well, and it leads me to two, you know, I wrote this book because, not that I'm a medication basher, but having been a therapist, and, you know, and you've done clinical work, having been a therapist for a long time, medications don't work for everybody. Even if they work, there are sometimes side effects which people don't prefer, and there's expenses to them. And sometimes they work a little, but they don't work to solve everything. And so I thought, I've used these six different methods to help people move out of depression because I know it from the inside out, and I've been a therapist for, you know, since the 1970s. So I've been a therapist for a long time, and I've helped a lot of people with depression with, in addition to or outside of medications. And so in my story, there are really two of the six solutions that I use regularly with people. One of them is to stop being so isolated and get some social connection. You've done a lot of shows on positive psychology.
Yes.
And one of the consistent findings in positive psychology is when people have good social relationships, they're happier. And so you can imagine that the opposite is also true, that if they're isolated, lonely, there's been some studies, that's a stressful thing. We human beings evolved in groups and tribes, and being alone is not good for us physiologically, psychologically, emotionally, and just getting along in life. And so one of the things was having that friend saved my life, brought me out of that depression in some ways. The second thing was, most people, when they go to treat people in psychotherapy, they go back to the past. Where did this depression come from? I went into the future. I imagined a future where I could be better, where things would be better. And so I've used that future strategy, which, again, I know you know Milton Erickson's work. Milton Erickson was a great future-oriented psychotherapist, so was Jung to a certain extent, so was Adler, I'm told, although I'm not that familiar with Adler's future work. But I use the future a lot because I think one of the things that collapses in when people are depressed is that sense of future mindedness. They sometimes get stuck in the present and they're suffering in the present, or they orient to the troubled past. And I think orienting people to a future with possibilities that's compelling and that can pull them forward, I call this future pull, is one of the ways to start to pull out of depression.
Yeah, you know, I just recently interviewed Philip Zimbardo because he's got a book
that's all about future.
Future orientation.
All these time orientations people can have. And I discovered that a long time ago, but reading Zimbardo's book kind of put it into a framework because he's good at that framework stuff, and he's done research on this.
Yeah, and that's also one of the things that that really jumped out for me in Jung's work was the idea that there is a future out there that's kind of pulling us, that we have a unique destiny, just like a seed has its own unique destiny to turn into, you know, whatever kind of seed it is as it develops.
Like the acorn turns into the oak, you know.
Exactly.
I think, you know, some of the Jungians, James Hillman talked about that. I remember the great story that he told about who was it, the singer, Ella Fitzgerald. She was, I guess, in Harlem about to do her first talent show on the stage of the Apollo. And the host said, oh, now we have little Ella Fitzgerald, who is like 11 years old or something like that, who's going to dance. And then all of a sudden he feels this tugging at his sleeve, and he leans down and she whispers in his ear, and he said, ah, she was going to dance, but now she's going to sing for us. And she decides at that moment, she gets too nervous about dancing, she's going to sing. They bring her back for 3 standing ovations, and her future came and got her. And what Hillman said, who was a Jungian, sort of a neo-Jungian, and post-Jungian maybe, but he said, I think the acorn of her singing career started to blossom at that, started to, you know, sprout at that particular point, and her future came to get her. Her destiny came to get her. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I've developed a bunch of questions to kind of lead us through the interview, and you can feel free to go anywhere you want to.
Well, you know, this is you wrote me and said, is there a particular passage in the book you'd like to read? This is a perfect spot to read that passage.
Oh, good, because I had totally forgotten about the passage asking you to do that. So please do.
Because what you were just talking about, this future pull thing,
yeah.
I knew that from my own experience because my friend had said, hey, out in this future, you can go live in this farmhouse. There's something worth living for. Live towards this thing rather than in the misery. All you have is the misery you have now, or it's going to get worse in the future. And so years later, and I know you know about this conference, I went to the Evolution of Psychotherapy conference, which is kind of the Woodstock of psychotherapy with all the famous therapists there.
Yes.
I went to the first couple, 1985 and 1990, and they have them every 3, 4, 5 years. And Viktor Frankl, who I know you know about, and a lot of people probably listening know about Frankl. He wrote the famous book, Man's Search for Meaning. He was a Viennese psychiatrist and had a big influence on the field of therapy and psychology. And so I heard him give a keynote address at this conference, the Evolution of Psychotherapy Conference in Anaheim in 1990. And so let me just read you this excerpt that relates to both my experience, Frankl's experience, and this, the fifth strategy for coming out of depression, which I call future pull or future with possibilities. the Viktor Frankl strategy. I sometimes call this hope restoration strategy the Viktor Frankl strategy. Frankl, author of the bestseller Man's Search for Meaning, was a Holocaust survivor. He was arrested in the 1940s with his wife and parents and sent to a concentration camp. Frankl survived. His wife and parents did not. At a conference in 1990 in Anaheim, California, I heard Frankl talk about his life and work. In that talk, he told a story that struck me as a powerful example of this futures with possibility strategy. Frankl had been transferred from that first concentration camp to several others and ended his captivity in the fourth camp, which was situated in what was then Poland. He had kept himself going in part with his work and a sense that he had a contribution to make to the field of mental health. He'd been a student and protege of Alfred Adler until he'd begun to develop his own ideas and was pushed out of Adler's inner circle. Frankl's original idea was that instead of Adler's will to power, humans' most powerful driver is a will to meaning. He had begun to write a book about this idea when he was arrested by the Nazis, and they burned his manuscript just after he arrived at the first camp. Thus, the only place this idea existed was in Frankl's mind. He distracted himself for many hours while in prison by writing the book over and over again in his mind and giving imaginary lectures about the topic. Mm. He survived several life-threatening incidents and began to have the idea that perhaps he was being kept alive for a purpose. But one day, near the end of the war, his faith was challenged. Allied bombers had been making more and more incursions into German-held territory and then recently bombed a crucial bridge that was part of the German supply line. Frankl and his fellow prisoners were to be marched through the bitter winter cold to repair the bridge. As they were marching through a snow-covered field, the wind was blowing bitterly. Frankl had been ill with some sort of respiratory illness, and he was dressed in clothing too thin for the weather. He began to cough, and one cough brought on another until he found himself collapsing to one knee in the snowy field, unable to proceed. The guard came over and told Frankl to get up and keep walking. He was slowing down the line and everyone was freezing. But Frankl couldn't get up. He was too ill and too weak. At his lack of response, the guard became enraged and began beating Frankl. Frankl collapsed to all fours. Prior to this time, Frankl had had the sense that he was being kept alive for a purpose, but he suddenly thought that he had been deluding himself. He was going to die right there in this snowy field. He didn't have the wherewithal to get up and keep walking. Then, to his own surprise, he found himself no longer in the field, but instead he was giving an imaginary lecture in post-war Vienna on the psychology of death camps and the psychology of meaning. Every word in this imaginary lecture was just right, poignant, and nuanced. The audience was riveted. Frankl told them about the day he almost died outside the death camp in Poland. He had almost given up hope, and then, wonder of wonders, he found the strength to get up. Just as he was imagining this part of the future lecture in the field in Poland, he got up. He then told the imaginary audience that he took one step and then another, that his feet hurt, his chest hurt, his back hurt, but he was walking. Meanwhile, in Poland, he began to walk. He continued imagining the future lecture the whole time he walked out to the work detail and rotely did what he needed to do. Time stretched out and he continued to be absorbed in this imaginary future lecture until he arrived back at the camp. He fell asleep that night, imagining getting a standing ovation from a future imaginary audience. I saw Frankl speak and heard him tell that story 52 years later. He got a standing ovation from the audience in California at the conclusion of his talk there. Frankl had created that imagined future and was living in it when I saw him.
Wow, I almost tear up hearing that story.
I do occasionally when I tell it. Sometimes I tell it.
Yeah.
And I can't get through it exactly. It's so moving to me. And, you know, I saw him near the end of his life, and he was physically ill, you know, not doing well, but his spirit was so alive. Here he was 52 years later, and he had created, stepped into such a future. I was just so moved by, I was always moved by his work, but so moved by hearing him tell that story. And it struck me like a lightning bolt. I was sitting in the front row and I was like, that's me. That's exactly what happened to me. Why don't we talk about the future more in psychotherapy? We're so focused on the past and where the problems came from. A lot of people keep themselves going because they have hope for the future. We should be doing more of that when we work with people.
Yeah, and one of the ways that one can see what a big impact that had on you is just like my nom de guerre here is Dr. Dave. I notice in your email address, you're Possibil.
Possibil, that's right.
Right? Your name is Bill and you're Possibil.
I named my whole company Possibilities because to me, that saved my life. Is when I had no possibilities, I felt hopeless. When I had possibilities, I felt some hope.
Yeah.
And I think, you know this because it's been part of, David Frank or what was his name in the 50s. One of the components of successful psychotherapy is hope. And now with these common factors that a lot of people are talking about, one of them is positive expectancy, the placebo effect. It makes a difference. If people have hope that something will work, it often works.
Yes, yes. Now, I could have – my usual approach probably would have been to step you through your chapters so that you could really go into each of the six approaches, but I decided against that. People can go out and buy your book, and I don't want to undercut it by marching right through it. So instead,
either way, whatever works for you.
But feel free to throw them in as we go through, as you've been doing, and instead, I've got questions that are more oriented towards some of these approaches that you've drawn upon, which you've already started mentioning. I like your humility around the topic of depression. You don't claim to be the world's biggest expert on depression. You don't even go into discussing the causes of depression or the various theories. Maybe you can say something here about that choice that you made.
Well, it's funny because this comes right out of a workshop that I taught. I was teaching a workshop once on how to get over depression, and someone came up and said, "Oh, I'm so glad I'm at this workshop. I went to one last month, and the whole morning was spent on the World Health Organization's definition and criteria for depression. It was 3 hours in the morning, and I want to help people. I can read the book to find what the definition is." And I thought, we don't need another book about what depression is, because that's been spelled out. And if you've had it, or if you've seen somebody with it, you have a pretty good sense of what it is. What causes it? That's a slightly different thing. And, again, I was influenced a lot by my own experience and by studying with the late psychiatrist Milton Erickson. Erickson was, again, I think a possibility-oriented, resource-oriented therapist, and he was more interested in the present toward the future. When I was in graduate school, I was studying with Erickson. I didn't have any money to pay him, so I was his gardener while I was in graduate school. And I was in a year-long psychotherapy pro seminar, they call it. There were only five of us in the class, and we had to choose a theorist. And our task was to write final paper. We had to spend 20 pages talking about this theorist's theory of how problems developed. There's kind of psychopathology theory. And then half of it was their theory of health and intervention. And I got to the end of the course. I had picked Erickson because I was studying with him. And I went in desperation to my teacher and I said, "I can't do this paper. I can't find any much of a theory that Erickson had about how problems develop. He just doesn't talk about it much. He talks a lot about how to help people change." But she said, "Well, that's fine. Just, make as much of the paper as you can on the theory of problem development and then make the rest of it on problem." And I ended up writing three paragraphs on problem development. So I think I inherited that bias because Erickson was such a strong influence on me. And I can tell you what I wrote in that three paragraphs, and that is it's one of these interventions for depression as well, these non-medication interventions. Erickson, if I can summarize those three paragraphs quickly, his theory of problem development was sometimes we're a little too rigid and we fall into patterns. It's not good for us and we should be more flexible. That's his theory of psychopathology as far as I can tell. And I read everything that Erickson ever wrote or said. Yeah. I was obsessed with him for many years. So that, and I still hold to that. And now we know, and again, I know you've done a bunch of shows because I'm a faithful listener of your show on brain plasticity, all this new brain science, which when you and I were coming up back in the Paleolithic era of psychology, we were taught the brain was fixed and it didn't grow as adults. It didn't change. It didn't grow. No new brain cells were born. Now we know that's a bunch of bunk. And Erickson was a true believer in that a long time ago. If your brain gets grooved in a certain way, you're going to keep feeling feeling the same way, keep doing the same things, keep having the same results, like the old 12-step saying, you know, that insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Erison would get people to do something different, and that's one of these strategies I have for moving people out of depression. They get their brains get grooved, their lives get grooved, and sometimes they say the only difference between a rut and a grave is the dimensions, and sometimes people who are depressed got into a pretty deep rut.
Yeah, that's a good example. You in several places in the book, you talk about the brain getting grooved. And that's a great example of down-to-earth language, right? Yeah. It's, you know, literally in terms, I'm sure a neuroscientist would probably drop in a dead faint, you know. Yeah, the brain gets grooved. But
We'll call it myelinating for them.
but for most of us, that really communicates, getting in a rut.
You know, again, you and I grew up in this era, so maybe younger people won't relate to this analogy, but it's like records had a little groove, and it takes a little effort to get it to jump out of that groove.
Yeah.
And if you keep going in the same groove, you're going to keep hearing the same song emotionally, psychologically, neurologically, and physiologically. And that's the good news and the bad news about brain plasticity is the brain gets really efficient when you keep doing the same thing over and over again. You've done your show for a long time now. You're good at it. You can do it quickly. You can do it well. If you try to do something that was way outside your – or a little outside your comfort zone, it would feel a bit uncomfortable. But then if you did it a few times – that would feel more comfortable to you. And that's the nice part about the brain. It's adaptable, but it takes a little effort to jump out of the groove.
Yeah, and I'm impressed by the degree to which you jumped out of the groove. Because as you mentioned, you know, you were very much in the groove of Milton Erickson. And in this book, I was really impressed to see how you reached out and you drew from so many different areas. So, yes, Erickson has had a big impact on you and on your work and the way that you phrase interventions, which I think is quite wonderful. I love all the examples that you give in there. But you also draw from positive psychology, which you've mentioned, in cognitive behavioral and mindfulness and Jung and Joseph Campbell and neuroscience and the brain.
Well, I think you and I have both been cursed by an ability to be lifelong curiosity learners. You know, yeah. I just want to know everything. And I, again, listening to your show, I know you're endlessly curious. To tell you the truth, I don't understand people who've learned something and then never want to learn anything new. I find it fascinating. It keeps my brain alive. It keeps my life alive. And, you know, it helps me get more competent so I can help other people, more people. And, you know, I just don't understand that. So, yeah, I love to learn new things.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm gonna groove us a little here in a new direction. And that is, you mentioned Erickson, and I want to make a weird connection that's probably never been made on your show between Milton Erickson and Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, go for it.
Usually those aren't mentioned in the same category, probably. But Milton Erickson was the late psychiatrist that we've been talking about, and you know about his work, but maybe people who aren't familiar, he was a hypnotherapist as well. And he had a really interesting approach. He didn't believe there was such a thing as resistance. He just figured the way you approach people was probably a way you could not either evoke resistance to change or evoke cooperation. And he had a really interesting thing that he told me one time. He said, if you can't say the no, the patient will say the no. So he developed this approach, which was a little like that Asian yin and yang thing of including not changing with changing. Including the no with the yes. And so I got very fascinated. I heard actually a talk by an historian named David Wolf Shank, I'm sorry. He wrote a book about Lincoln's depression, Abraham Lincoln, the American president's depression. And he was suicidally depressed twice in his life and had a tendency towards depression his whole life, even after he became president, was quite successful. And he had a kind of a paradoxical character. He could be the life of the party, very funny, very droll, very optimistic. He was future-oriented. And at the same time, he had this tendency towards morbid depression, which they called melancholy in those days. So I heard this talk by this historian, and he read a letter that Lincoln sent to someone during the middle of the Civil War, a daughter of one of his generals that had been killed, and she'd become severely depressed and taken to her bed for the last year or so. And Lincoln took the time out of his busy war schedule and wrote her this short letter, which to me sounded much like Erickson in that I think when we meet with people who are depressed, we can't just say, cheer up, you can change, everything's going to be okay. That doesn't work. But you also can't just say, look at, you're depressed and there's nothing you can do about it. You have to find that yin and yang happy medium. And this letter, again, makes me cry sometimes. It tears me up. So I'll see if I can get through it here. Dear Fanny, it is with deep grief that I learn of the death of your kind and brave father, and especially that it is affecting your young heart beyond what is common in all such cases. In this sad world of ours, sorrow comes to all. And to the young, it comes with bitterest agony because it takes them unawares. The older have learned to ever expect it. I am anxious to afford some alleviation of your present distress. Perfect relief is not possible except with time. You cannot now realize that you will ever feel better. Is this not so?
That's a pure Ericksonian phrasing.
Yeah, with the double and triple negatives. Let me read it again.
Yeah.
You cannot now realize that you will ever feel better. Is this not so?
Now, unpack that for us a little bit. Why is that such a powerful thing?
It's kind of confusing in a certain way, all those negatives in there. But he's saying a positive thing in a negative way. He's using the no to say a yes. So you cannot now realize. So he's presuming that this is true, whatever comes after that. You cannot now realize that you will ever feel better. So he's giving her hope. Is this not so? And then he goes on to make a positive statement after all these negatives. And yet it is a mistake. You are sure to be happy again. To know this, which is certainly true, will make you some less miserable now. He doesn't say you'll be happy. You'll be happy again someday, but it'll make you some less miserable now just to have hope that sometime in the future you'll feel better. I have had experience enough to know what I say, and you need only believe it to feel better at once. Now, this young woman, Fanny McCullough, had known Lincoln had been depressed. Her father had helped Lincoln through some of his depressions. So here's a guy saying, I was depressed, you're depressed, take my word for it. It can get better, and it will get better over time. And life is full of sorrow. You think this is an unusual event, but as you grow up, you'll discover, and you know, you and I are of a certain age, we've seen some of our friends, some of our family, our parents die. It's a part of life. And yes, it hits you hard, but after a while, you realize this is the nature of life. And I just was so touched by the kindness in that letter, but also the inclusiveness, the yes and no, the hopelessness along with the hope.
Yeah, there are sort of these embedded suggestions in there.
Yes, as you say, it could have been an Ericksonian intervention, induction, hypnotic induction. It sounded a lot like Erickson's way of doing things. And here was doing it in 1863. Sorry.
Right, and you say Erickson didn't believe in resistance. It seemed like he developed ways to make resistance not possible. I think that's part of the art of hypnosis. There are these contradictory suggestions there. So you can't resist because either you go with a yes or you go with a no. It's very permissive. Both are possible.
He would sometimes pull a person's hand up and say, you can't not put it down, can you not? It's like that. And as that one goes down, the other one can go up. You know, he would do these contradictory, weird things. And it was confusing, but also it was almost impossible to resist. Yeah.
Where did he come up with this stuff? Did he have a teacher himself, or is he just...
Creative originals. I remember hearing the story, actually, where he came up with that kind of approach. He grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, and his father was trying to pull a stubborn calf into the barn one day, and the calf was just digging in its heels and wouldn't go. And Erickson said, "You keep pulling on the front, Dad." And Erickson pulled the calf's tail, and the calf, to resist Erickson pulling him in the other direction, ran into the barn. So I think he learned it early on. He was just a creative kid who found a different way to approach things. And he used that all his life, in his therapy and in life.
Yeah. Another thing that I really like in the book is how careful and supportive you are, just like in the Lincoln passage that you just read. It's easy to come on with some technique that one's heard about, or, you know, trying to be Milton Erickson or something, and to be techniquey without compassion. And you keep emphasizing the importance of not doing something like that. I don't know if I'm saying it well, but you said in the book.
You know, all good change work, all good work in this world, when we're trying to make a change, which is so difficult at times, stands on two legs. One is acknowledgement and validation, that Carl Rogers stuff that you and I learned at the beginning of our careers. Just join with people. Don't try and judge them or try and fix them or make them change. Just be there with them in a compassionate, caring, listening, open, supportive way. But if that's all you do, sometimes people don't get challenged enough to get out of that brain groove, to get out of that emotional groove. So I think the second leg you have to stand on, if you only stand on one leg, it's a little wobbly and doesn't get supported. The second leg is invitation to new possibilities and change. And so finding the artful way and the compassionate way to combine those two, to be right with the person, say, "You don't have to change. I'm right here with you now. You're okay as you are. And you want to come over here? You want to make this change? Here's a possibility." And then people, I think, if you treat them with compassion and respect and join them right where they are and validate them, they'll often move with you where you invite them to go. I think it's a little like the sport of curling. You sweep right in front of the stone. If you sweep 15 feet ahead of the stone, it doesn't make any difference for the stone. If you go back into the past and you sweep in their childhood, it doesn't make any difference. You have to join with them right in this moment, sweep open possibilities, and then notice where the stone is moving and help them. You know, lead and follow at the same time like you do when you dance.
Oh, that's a great metaphor. If I was recording a little segment for a billboard up front of the interview like I used to do, that would have been a good one.
That would have been excellent. I remember those little excerpts. Yeah.
You mentioned several famous depressives in the book, Abraham Lincoln being one, and you just now alluded to Carl Rogers, and I believe he struggled with depression quite a bit.
I did not know that, but I know he struggled with some various things in his life. William Styron, the novelist, was another famous person who suffered from depression and wrote a wonderful book about it. And Winston Churchill was another famous person who called it the Black Dog, I think, was his name for depression. And I quote liberally, actually, in the book from Andrew Solomon's book. Andrew Solomon, if you've ever heard his TED Talks, they're wonderful. Go watch his TED Talks. And his book, The Noonday Demon, it was an atlas of depression. He became severely depressed, again, almost suicidal. And his father saved his life. His father came over and sat with him while he was depressed and just miserable. And he's very poignant in how he talks about it. But he went around the world after he recovered from his serious bouts of depression and anxiety and decided he would investigate all the culture in the world, how they thought about depression, how they treated it. And it's a fascinating book. He's quite an erudite guy. It's a little thick and a little hard for most people to read. But I think a lot of famous people suffer from depression. And again, like as you and I were talking about earlier, sometimes it made their work better. It made their lives more meaningful. And then Andrew Solomon talks about this. He says, "I think I'm a kinder person. I'm more compassionate. I'm more patient with other people." And he's written several compassionate books after that about people who struggle in various ways. And I think it came right out of his wounds. I think, you know, that Rogers obviously developed this great compassion and compassionate approach to people. And if it came out of his depression, I wouldn't at all be surprised.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, what are the potential gifts of depression? And you've just alluded to some.
Well, you know, I'll just say this one little thing that rides on this. Joseph Campbell years ago, when Bill Maher was interviewing him on the famous Power of Myth program that was on our American public television, now is on DVD and streaming, is he said, you know, he asked Bill Maher asked Joseph Campbell, if you had a student came to you and said, how do I figure out what to do with my life? He said, follow your bliss. And then years later, everyone was like, follow your bliss. And it was during kind of, again, hippie times. Everyone was saying, just follow what feels good. And Campbell said, that's not exactly what I meant. I meant what's deeply meaningful and joyful to your soul. And people are going and talking about it as being kind of hedonistic. That is not what I meant. He said, maybe I should have said instead, follow your blisters. Because it's also sometimes you follow your wound. So it's not just follow your bliss, it's follow your wound. And I think that at least in my life and in a few other people that I studied as case studies for this book, following your wound can be a more powerful path, or combining following your wound with following your bliss can be a powerful path to finding meaning and purpose in life.
Yeah. Something else you write about is what you call the three C's of post-depression thriving.
You know, it's an interesting thing because people often only see the negative effects of suffering. But as you and I were just talking about, there can be these positive effects, but they're not guaranteed. You could be depressed, come out of it, or get a little better and have it be a continued suffering for you, or source of shame, or source of shrinkage for you, if you will, you know, that you don't grow from it. But I think there are some commonalities that people who take these terrible experiences in life, these wounds, these depression experiences, and turn them into something that's actually full of meaning and gives them a direction for life. And yeah, there are three C's. I think, you know, in my story, in the story that I read you from Lincoln, if you can, after you're depressed or through the experience of depression, connect more deeply with yourself. So the first C is connection. Connect more deeply to yourself, to others, and to something bigger and beyond, a bigger purpose and meaning, or maybe a spiritual connection to God or to the universe or whatever you consider spirituality, that can help turn it from post-traumatic or post-depressive stress in wounding to a growth experience. There's all this research on post-traumatic growth, and that's one of the things that happens. You develop better relationships with other people, more meaningful sense of your own life. And so the second C is, can you become more compassionate towards yourself, a little less harsh and judgmental and self-critical, and towards other people who are suffering? Does it call you to be more compassionate to other people? And the third thing, can you take your suffering and then move it out into the world and help other people? That Lincoln letter was a good example of it. He was so compassionate and he wanted to contribute. He was beleaguered during the middle of the Civil War. The North was losing. He had barely had any time, but he took some time out of his busy schedule and wrote a kind letter to someone who was suffering. Can you take this terrible experience and turn it into something that makes the world a better place, or contributes to other people, or relieves the suffering and pain of other people? If you can do that, you can make meaning after depression and sort of come out of it in a way better. I don't mean to make light of the experience of depression, because I wouldn't wish it on my, well, maybe I wish it on my worst enemy, but I wouldn't wish it on most people. Let's say that.
Yeah. You've alluded to the fact that both of us are moving on in life here, pretty far down the road. What about depression in later life? I mean, that's kind of known to be an issue. Have you worked with people, older people, around depression? And
yes,
do these same principles apply, or are there special guidelines?
I think there's an extra guideline, because as we were talking earlier about brain plasticity, it's not true that we can't grow any new brain cells or make new connections as we go along. You're learning as you're in your dotage here. I'm in my dotage. I'm still learning and still, you know, enjoying learning new stuff and changing. But it's not guaranteed that you'll get new brain cells. If you don't stay active, if you don't keep your mind active, your brain pumps out fewer cells, makes fewer new connections. So I think a special thing, and one of the six ways in this book, the six non-medication ways to relieve depression, one that really surprised me, to tell you the truth, as powerful as it was, is you got to get moving. Now, we know that's good for your heart. We know that's good for your general health. But it turns out it's really good for the brain, and a subsection of that, it's really good for depression, because one of the things that when you're depressed, because it's a stressful condition, and maybe stress in part led to the start of your depression or the help depression come on. When you're stressed, you're creating fewer brain cells in the hippocampus, part of the brain that typically pumps out new brain cells. So you, in order to contradict that, the best thing you can do, even better than medications, which may help, is to get moving. Even walking 3 times a week, as little as 20 minutes a time. And I know that's hard for people who are depressed, but you just start with baby steps. You walk up one flight of stairs and then take the elevator the rest of the flight. You park a little farther away from the grocery store or the shopping mall. You get up and walk around your bedroom if that's all you can do. You do anything you can do to get moving. If you can't move your legs, move your arms. Get your body moving, and especially if it can be aerobic exercise, even minor aerobics, that's been correlated with more new brain cells, and that turns out to be an antidepressant, a powerful antidepressant, sometimes more long-lasting and more powerful than antidepressants.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? And not long after we conclude our interview here, I'll be getting on my exercise bike.
Yeah. Well, I've started to do it, and I was a dedicated couch potato most of my life. Now, as I get older, I don't want to have the midlife tummy as much, and I do want to make sure my heart is healthy, and I do all those preventative things. But I really started exercising for my brain. It has the most powerful antidepressant effect of those who are depressed. Those people who feel pretty good, they probably won't feel the antidepressant effect. But if you're depressed and you can get yourself moving, research indicates that that can really help lift your mood and give you a little traction out of depression or a lot of traction out of depression.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the promising new possibilities you see on the horizon for relieving depression?
Well, first of all, I think we're at the very beginning of even understanding what is depression. You see these commercials on television, they show you like they've got to figure it out, but this is a hypothesis that they're giving you. There is, in fact, that hypothesis is starting to crumble under the weight of new evidence, this serotonin deficiency hypothesis. So the first thing I'll say in answer to your question is, I think we're just at the beginning of learning about depression. We're going to learn about the genetics of it. We're going to learn about the biochemistry of it. We're going to learn some of these prevention techniques. We're going to learn some of these quicker recovery techniques. And I think, where a lot of the juice is these days is in this brain plasticity. It's in this neuroplasticity. We're going to find out how to stimulate parts of the brain, both with, light and electricity and exercise and nutrition and other things. We're going to learn to manage the environment around the person so they're less likely to get depressed. Or if they get depressed, we'll know the things to do, make sure they don't stay isolated. Being a psychologist for so long, when anybody suffers from any kind of emotional or mental or relational problem, they often pull away from other people because they're ashamed or they're irritated or it's hard to be around them. They either push people away or pull people away. We know this is the worst thing for depression, to stay isolated. I mean, there are moments when you need to be by yourself and, just do what you need to do. But if you're spending a lot of time alone, really bad. So I think we're going to learn more things about this. There are, deep brain vagal stimulators that are coming up, games. They're gamifying depression. Again, another great TED talk is by a woman named McGonigal.
Yes.
And
yes,
she gamified her recovery in one of her TED talks. She talked about gamifying her recovery from some brain damage that was really, she was depressed. And she made a game of all these milestones in her recovery and to get herself up and moving. And I think gamifying for the younger folks, having apps and games that can help them win points and get social support to move out of depression. I think there are a lot of new possibilities. And obviously, I put six of the most promising ones, but I put an end chapter in there saying, here's a bunch of stuff we don't know about yet, but looks really promising. And those are a couple that come to mind.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there was one more question I wanted to ask you. Oh, yeah. Yeah, since you've listened to this show a lot, you've heard me talk about that I have the sense of some convergence where psychology, psychotherapy used to be chopped up into all these different approaches. And yeah. I have a sense of some kind of coming together. What's your take on that?
I think that's true. And I think in some ways, you know, when people say what's new in psychotherapy, saying it's a lot of, you know, the new brain science stuff is pretty interesting. Positive psychology is pretty interesting. But really, there's not so much new. It's more what you're talking about. And it's maybe psychology, psychotherapy coming out of its infancy and adolescence into adulthood, saying we don't need to fight about who's right and who's wrong. You know, most therapists that I know go to every kind of conference. They're not doctrinaire, but when you and I were coming up, you had to declare what school you are. Are you an Adlerian? Yeah. Are you a Hornian? Are you a Freudian? Are you a Jungian? Are you a Gestalt therapist? You know, you had to choose your tribe. And I'd say now, I'm a possibilitarian, number one, like possibilities. But secondly, I'll use something from here. I'll use something from there. On your show, you're interviewing people from, you know, hundreds of different perspectives, and they all have a piece of the truth. It's like that elephant, you know, that old elephant thing. We got the tail here, we got the trunk here. And if you think that when you have the tail, you have the whole thing, you're wrong. I see this as the great movement in psychology and psychotherapy, the coming together and the stopping of the internecine feuds that were very common when you and I were coming up, and people wouldn't talk to one another. They were Freudians and they split with Freud. They never talked to him again. It's like, oh, come on. You know, that's just crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's
looking for what works, and that's all I care about. You know, what's compassionate and what works.
Yeah. Well, that's a great wrap.
It's a wrap. It's a shrink wrap.
Yeah. Possible Bill O'Hanlon. Thanks for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. It's always fun to talk with you. We always have such great conversations.
I really do enjoy speaking with Bill O'Hanlon, and I certainly hope this won't be the last time. I think we have a lot in common. We're both very eclectic and oriented toward the practical. I've also wrestled with depression during my life, including one episode about 20 or 30 years ago in which I was feeling quite suicidal. All you therapists out there will be aware that depression is a huge problem. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if people suffering from depression constitute a large portion of your practice. Allow me to read a passage from Bill's book in which he documents the severity of the problem. I quote from page 5, "Depression can be devastating for those who experience it as well as costly for their loved ones and society. Economists estimate that in the United States, depression costs us $43 billion every year. While we would do well to be skeptical of hard and fast numbers and percentages when it comes to depression, the World Health Organization in 2011 estimates that depression affects 121 million people worldwide. In 2000, depression was the leading cause of disability and the fourth leading contributor to the global burden of disease. Depression is currently the second leading cause of disability for people between the ages of 15 and 44, and it is estimated that fewer than 25% of those affected have access to effective treatments." That's according to the World Health Organization in 2011. He goes on to say, "In the United States, an estimated 20.9 million adults, that's 9.5%, of the U.S. population aged 18 or older, suffer from a mood disorder, and more than two-thirds of them, that's 14.8 million U.S. adults, have major depression. Depressive disorders often co-occur with anxiety disorders, according to the National Institutes of Mental Health, 2011. But beyond all those statistics, knowing the toll that depression exacts in personal suffering and much too often in suicide is what should move us to find anything that has the potential to assist even one more person who hasn't yet been helped. End quote. Bill and I also share an interest in hypnosis and the work of Milton Erickson. I have to say I'm terribly envious of the fact that he got to study with Erickson for a whole year, and I'm regretful that I never made the pilgrimage to see Erickson when he was still alive. In part, I think that was because I didn't know that was an option. Something else we might share is the shyness he spoke of when he was young. He certainly doesn't seem shy now, having led workshops all over the world for many years now. I don't know if he transcended that shyness or not. I'm thinking he might be like me, in as much as I can be quite extroverted when I'm empowered by a role. Outside of that role, depending upon the situation, I might be more of a wallflower. I believe Philip Zimbardo, who has researched and written about shyness, among other things, described this as the shy extrovert. So, Bill, if you're listening, does that describe you or not? As you heard, I'm quite enthusiastic about Bill's book. You heard me describe the conversational tone in which it's written. However, you would be mistaken if you conclude that it is shallow. Even though his book has a casual, conversational tone, it also has a very earnest, educational force about it, with sample dialogues, case histories, and plenty of research references. Yes, as the subtitle of the book suggests, he outlined 6 non-medication ways to relieve depression, and it would be very easy to just read that list of 6 here and now, but I would be doing the book a disservice because he actually goes into considerable depth and elaboration for each. So you'll just have to go ahead and get the book. And if you are a therapist, you really should do so. Working with depressed people can be quite draining, and so it's important to expose yourself to inspirational material and new techniques which will keep your batteries charged. Beyond this, this is a book that you may well want to loan out to selected clients or to recommend that they purchase and read. And any of my listeners out there who are not therapists themselves, but who are dealing with depression or a tendency in that direction, I think you would get some solid information here that would help you to navigate your way out of that state. As always, you can order the book, which is titled Out of the Blue, 6 Non-Medication Ways to Relieve Depression by Bill O'Hanlon, using the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Gloria Ullman from Adelaide in South Australia, and I just want to let you know I'm going through all of the podcasts at the moment, right from the start, as a project to make up folders for people who don't have access to the internet and who are very interested in this kind of thing. So I'm making up folders that I think are of particular interest to the people that I have in mind. There's only 2 or 3 of them, so it's not that big a deal. But it really is a labor of love, and it makes me once again deeply appreciate what a goldmine this podcast is. I'm also making my annual donation, and it's not as much as I would really like to donate, but it's as much as I can afford at the moment. I'm not sure if you're aware, but in Australia, the exchange rate with the American dollar is not very high at the moment. So for every, say, $100 that Australians spend in American dollars, it costs us $115 at the moment. It's not very good, but it has been worse. Thank you once again for your wonderful podcast. Goodbye.
Thank you, Gloria, for that wonderful endorsement and for your labor of love, not only on the folders that you're preparing for friends and for your financial support, but also for all the many shows that you've transcribed. You've been a true collaborator with me here in keeping Shrink Wrap Radio alive and healthy. And thanks to Matthew Dowlitz of the Neuropsychotherapist, we have some newer, fancier transcripts. He redoes the transcripts so that they are graphically beautiful, giving them the high production value that characterizes his online journal/magazine, The Neuropsychotherapist. Matthew also makes a regular monthly contribution to Shrink Wrap Radio, and so I want to publicly thank him for his ardent help. And here are the episodes with redone transcripts. Number 389, The Brain Bible with John B. Arden. Number 348, Nutrition and Mental Health with Whole Psychiatry founder Dr. Robert Hedaya. And number 336, The Neuroscience of Psychotherapy with Dr. Louis Cozzolino. Finally, if you are new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that there is an app for that, which is to say we have an app for listening to the 75 most recent Shrink Wrap Radio episodes on your iOS or Android device. Just click on the Apps tab at the top of the homepage on Shrink Wrap Radio for full details. Also, don't forget about the International Association for the Study of Dreams Conference in Berkeley, California, running June 4th through the 8th of 2014. It's open to all, and I hope to see you there. Click on the link in the left-hand sidebar at Shrink Wrap Radio for full details and registration.
Shrink Wrap Radio is bringing it on down the line. Dr. Dave knows it's all in the mind.
Thank you, Louise Callanan, for that musical transition. I look forward to more from you and also encourage other musicians out there to see what you can come up with. I'm always hungry for new material to keep the show fresh. Now let's go to the email bag for recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio community. First, we hear from Rachel, a counselor and coach from British Columbia, who wrote to propose getting together during her visit to San Francisco. Unfortunately, that's not going to work out on my end or hers, but here's some of what she wrote in part. I look forward to hearing your next podcast, but no pressure for you to get to it quickly if you are overwhelmed, as I'm also happy to listen to older podcasts and often re-listen to previous podcasts. I think I have listened to The Fear Project at least 3 times after buying the ebook too. I can't recall if I let you know in past emails that I refer Shrink Wrap Radio to many clients, family, friends, and colleagues, as well as posting on my Facebook and other social media pages too. I refer other resources and podcasts too, but Shrink Wrap Radio is my most frequently shared podcast. This is one of the many reasons I like to support you financially. Take good care of yourself, and I do hope that we can meet sometime in the future. Warmest regards, and that's from Rachel. And Rachel, I really appreciate all the promoting that you're doing, the appreciation you have for Shrink Wrap Radio, and all that you're doing to promote it. And I hope that, in fact, it will work out that we can see each other sometime in the future, either in the San Francisco Bay Area or maybe up in, I think you're in Victoria, which I would love to visit. You can find out more about Rachel and her work by going to lifecareerstudio.com. The next one is from my buddy Oscar, who helped set up my dream workshop in Stockholm a few years ago. Oscar writes, "Dear David, I just had to report a strange synchronicity. Lately, I've been immersed with exploring the root chakra and the earthly energies, as I understand the connecting to these is vital for my recovery. Just today, I had a pleasant experience as I was lying outside, drowsing in the grass, and out of nowhere became viscerally aware of the earth as a female organism. It was quite erotic. When I came home, I had a kundalini rush during yoga and researched some yoga websites to find out more about the root chakra energies. One of them stated that if one has ever fallen and hit the tailbone, they should see a chiropractor because such strokes can mess up the root chakra. Interesting, I thought. Did I not fall on my butt quite badly one time as a kid, hitting the tailbone? It also read that root chakra issues are related to lower back pain and legs and feet weaknesses and problems. Then, since it's Thursday, I proceeded to listen to the new Shrink Wrap Radio episode. Lo and behold, after a few minutes, your interviewee tells the story about how he fell and hit his tailbone, disabling him from walking properly. And of course, he's referring to my recent interview with Bava Ram, or Brad Willis, the war correspondent who was healed by intensive yoga practice. So Oscar goes on to say, okay, now I'm going to listen to some grounding tunes and then go on with the rest of the interview. Best, Oscar. Oscar, it's always great to hear from you, and I know you to be a very sensitive individual who can pick up things like the female energies of the earth, which I'm somewhat impervious to, as you know. But I am impressed by that synchronicity between having gone through all of that, and then right after that, discovering that my latest interview related quite well to that experience and that research that you were doing. And as I've observed before, synchronicities between Shrink Wrap Radio and the listeners out there seem to be not infrequent. So I think that better wrap it up once again. You can send your emails to shrink at Shrink Wrap Radio. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our new message phone at 206-337-7170. You can also leave voicemails using the aforementioned iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Bill O'Hanlon for his ever-lively sharing in relation to non-medication ways of relieving depression. Be sure to listen next time when my guest will be Dr. Nina Burrows, a UK-based forensic psychologist who is also known as the cartooning psychologist, and will be speaking about her insights on rape, courage, and authenticity, as well as the how and why of her cartooning. I'll be looking for you then, and in the meantime, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.